Ladies and gentlemen, I think we'll get started. The Lowy Institute likes to start on time and finish on time. Welcome to the Lowy Institute at the NGV. I am Alex Oliver, Director of the Institute's Public Opinion Program. I manage and write the annual Lowy Institute polling project, some of you will be with, which has for 12 years provided real data on some of the important international issues of our time and debunked some misconceptions about what Australians really think about a wide range of policy issues such as the US alliance, relations with China, climate change and immigration, all of which are going to be relevant to tonight's discussion. With your leave, I'm filling in as chair for this panel for Sam Roggeveen, the editor of our online magazine, The Interpreter, and the head of our digital program, who's had a family emergency and couldn't make it this evening, for which my apologies. So at extremely short notice, at around 7:45am, I believe, this morning, Dan Flitton, senior correspondent for The Age, covering foreign affairs and politics, kindly agreed to take Sam's place. Thank you very much, Dan. Dan has always been incredibly generous to us and has given us his time, his wisdom and, most importantly, his wit at many of our events, and we're indebted to him to helping out tonight. As you can imagine, this has been an interesting week to work at an international think tank. If ever you wondered about the importance of the world to Australia and the relevance of international developments to our country, this week would have left you with no doubt. The candidate who had managed to offend so many people, do so many things and break so many rules that would seemingly disqualify him from being a presidential candidate, and who was not expected to win even after the votes started being counted, has actually won the presidency. As a commentator in The Atlantic magazine said back in August, the press have taken Trump literally but not seriously, while his supporters have taken him seriously but not literally. What we wanted to look at tonight is how this happened, why it happened, and what it might mean for the next 4 years. Joining me tonight are these two excellent panellists to discuss these issues and to start providing some answers to these thought-provoking questions. Dan Flitton, I've already briefly introduced. Before his role at Fairfax, he was a former intelligence analyst for the Australian government, and very relevantly for this evening, he was a Fulbright scholar in early 2004 studying the Australia-US alliance at the Ivy League Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. With us also is my colleague Aaron Connolly, the East Asia Program Research Fellow at the Institute. Aaron is an American and, dare I say it, a Floridian no less. His home state and even his home county helped deliver the presidency to Mr. Trump, but we won't hold you responsible, Aaron. Most importantly, he is an Asia expert and has experience working in Washington for Bill Clinton's National Security Advisor, Sandy Bergen. So just a little bit of housekeeping. We will have a discussion here amongst the panel for about a half an hour, and then we will go to a question and answer from you for about the last half an hour, and we will finish at 7:15. So we want to get to three main issues tonight. How did this happen? What does it mean for American politics? And what does it mean for the world? Firstly, Dan, how did this happen in your view? Can you talk a little bit about Donald Trump's approach to the campaign? How do you think he managed to win this race? And can the media, in fact, take any responsibility? Not Australian media, of course.
Well, we're as guilty as all the media, I think, in misunderstanding it. I've got a nice disclaimer, Alex, thank you. I did get a phone call. It was about 7:15. This morning, and I spent the week before the US election in China and was in Chengdu, one of the sort of secondary cities, the bigger cities. And like here, everybody that I was speaking to there was assuming that Hillary Clinton was going to be the next president. And that was true of Chinese officials, and I wouldn't say that we got to mingle a lot with locals, but as best we could, you know, the people we were talking to, everybody assumed that it was going to be Clinton. And is that a consequence of wishful thinking? Is it the way in which the media reflects the polity? It's always very difficult when you're a long way away from where the action's happening to read it. And one of the things that the media is grappling with in the wake of this election result is a realisation that what's been happening to our industry, the media industry, and this is as true in Australia as it is in the United States, over the last 10 years or however long, with the digital revolution and all of the costs that that's had in terms of the breadth of coverage, although we have so much more media than we ever did, we've been shrinking, the mainstream media has been shrinking its workforces. And a lot of that, in the US context, as it's happening here, has meant that journalists are no longer based and reporting for the big papers, the big media outlets, from some of the more rural areas or remote areas. So there does tend to be something of an echo chamber where reporters are based in big coastal cities, big coastal centres, big newsrooms, and those shrinking newsrooms means that we're less out in the field, if you like, talking to people. And so in that sense, yes, the media has to take responsibility for not properly understanding, not properly detecting, perhaps over-relying on polls to try and tell us the mood of the electorate, whereas sometimes you've got to do the old-fashioned shoe leather, go around, just talk to people, which requires a big investment from a media organisation. You've got to pay a salary of a reporter, you've got to get them out, pay the costs, if they're based out there, all of those things that are associated. And all of that's been shrinking, even though our media landscape has been broadening and changing, the traditional role of journalists has been shrinking. So, yeah, I think absolutely we do bear a real responsibility for having missed the mood of the electorate. And, you know, that's as true kind of you to sort of let Australian journalists off the hook to an extent. But Fairfax, my organisation...
Well, 77% of Australians thought that Hillary Clinton would have made a better Prime Minister, according to our polling. So, yes, you know, the Australians did take account of their media coverage of it.
And the New York Times had a correspondent, a former Middle East correspondent, who they tried to post out into sort of rural areas to report on America as if they were a foreign correspondent. Now, our correspondent who's based over there was trying to get their best sense of what was happening. But in this, we've fundamentally misread it. I think broadly saying.
Well, you weren't alone, with 9 out of 10 polls in America also fundamentally misread it. And I think the odds on the morning were about 90% for a Clinton win. So don't beat yourself up. Aaron, where do you think Hillary Clinton went wrong here? How did she lose this race? And I know you've got some thoughts about the way the media has worked in this case as well.
Yeah, so in the last few days, a narrative has emerged that Hillary Clinton wasn't a very good candidate, that she wasn't charismatic enough, that she was too close to establishment Democrats, to establishment institutions like banks and think tanks, that she was just a poor candidate for these times. And I have to tell you, I don't really buy it. Hillary Clinton was probably the most extraordinarily qualified candidate for president in the last 25 years. Rivaling George H.W. Bush. Had she made some mistakes in those 30 years in politics? Absolutely. And, but any politician who has some experience has some things to answer for. But there seemed to be a double standard in this election. We saw thousands of Hillary Clinton's emails. We saw zero of Donald Trump's emails, but we have a pretty good idea how he speaks in private based on the Access Hollywood tape. We saw 30 years of Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton's tax returns. We saw zero of Donald Trump's tax returns, but we have a pretty good sense that he avoided tens of millions of dollars in income tax over the last 20 years. So how can we explain this fact that these two candidates, who were so clearly unequal, there were so many disqualifying things in terms of Donald Trump's credentials and things he had said and done? And, one obvious explanation is that it's misogyny, that Americans hold women to a higher standard than they hold men. And they let Donald Trump get away with things that obviously Hillary Clinton never could get away with. But I actually think that some of it is not so much the media's fault, certainly not mainstream media institutions' fault. The Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, the Washington Post did a great job of holding Donald Trump to account and changing how they reported on him to make sure that they weren't normalizing his behavior. But when you log into a Facebook feed in the U.S. these days, If you're on the left, you're probably not going to get the New York Times or the Washington Post popping up in your feed. You're going to get a video from Now This or Fusion or Occupy Democrats. And these videos are not designed to inform. They're designed at the, you know, in sort of the most charitable interpretation to advocate. If you're on the right, it's actually much worse. At very best, you get a Fox News video that you know, distorts what has happened that day. At the worst, you get Breitbart News. And of course, Steve Bannon, who runs Breitbart News, is now apparently going into the Trump administration as the person two doors down from the Oval Office. And actually, we've learned in recent days, based on BuzzFeed News' reporting, that there's an even worse scenario, which is there were all these Montenegrin websites that were producing fake news about Hillary Clinton because they realized that the easiest way to get gullible people to click through and click on ads was to produce fake news about Hillary Clinton that got people angry. And so we were living in two completely different information environments. And that, to me, is the only way that you can actually get to a point where so many Americans, you know, some 48 million Americans, believe that Hillary Clinton is this sort of corrupt figure. It's not reality, but certainly enough Americans believed it.
The documentary maker Michael Moore, who was a fairly lonely voice predicting Trump's win back in July and also said that Bernie Sanders would have won, says he can't see Trump lasting the full 4 years. He said either he'll be impeached or he'll get bored. He has to go and live in this 200-year-old house that doesn't have a penthouse, it only has a second floor, and there's not even a putting green outside. Aaron, you've been around Washington a lot. You're a consultant on the Beltway. We know Trump has little interest in detail. He's an instinctive politician. He makes decisions from the gut. How do you think he'll govern? Do you think that there are sufficient checks and balances? Because I think a lot of people who are scared of the idea of a Trump presidency are falling back on these reassurances that there are sufficient checks and balances in place to pull him back from some of his more unusual or even extreme policies. Or to quote another foreign policy commentator, is it going to be amateur hour in DC? Should we be panicking?
So much depends upon who Donald Trump appoints to advise him. And we've seen conflicting signals in recent days. The two announcements that were made yesterday that Rince Priebus would be his chief of staff. Rince Priebus, pretty establishment Republican, runs the Republican National Committee. On the other hand, Steve Bannon being appointed as senior advisor, so sort of a competing chief of staff to Rince Priebus. Who's in his ear more? Who's giving him advice about what to say to the American people? On foreign policy, it'll be very interesting to see. We've seen some indications that Trump may go with establishment Republican figures like Steve Hadley, who we like because he was a distinguished international fellow at the Lowy Institute last year.
So he must be good.
And I've worked quite closely with Steve and think he's pretty top-notch. He's not ideological. He's looking for the best policy. And so if it's Steve Hadley, that's very good news. If, on the other hand, it's somebody like John Bolton or Newt Gingrich as Secretary of State, I'm not going to sugarcoat this for you. That's terrible news. That's really alarming. Mm-hmm. And you know, there are reports today that it might be John Bolton. These are people who are far outside the Republican mainstream. John Bolton couldn't even get a job in the second Bush administration for a number of years, and finally Bush gave him the ambassadorship to the United Nations. And Newt Gingrich has some very interesting ideas, like that we should colonize the moon. You know, that would be a very alarming development. But those are two very different administrations. And because Donald Trump has no foreign policy experience, no government experience, he's going to have to rely on those people to some great extent. And so I think that matters a lot. We'll find out in a few days what kind of administration it will be. I expect there will be a lot of internecine warfare. In the first term of President Bush's administration, there were a lot of debates. Debates is probably a nice word for them, between the State Department and the Defense Department and the National Security Council. I expect to see a lot more of that in a Trump administration, especially if he sets up competing power centers between, say, a Hadley and a Bolton.
Dan, yeah, this point about you know, these crazy foreign policies and this is going to be really bad. Apart from the bit about colonizing the moon, what is it going to mean in a broader sense to the world if some of these more extreme policies are actually put in place?
Well, in November last year, and I'm not claiming any prescience at all because I didn't think that Trump was going to win. But in November last year, I wrote a column and I started it by saying that if Donald Trump is the US president, then Australia should immediately abandon the ANZUS alliance. And I worked out that it takes 12 months to get out of the ANZUS treaty. There is actually a clause, and you have to give notice of withdrawal. And I said, tongue in cheek, but I said that that they should be, whether it was Malcolm Turnbull or Bill Shorten, because we hadn't had our own election then, that it was a bipartisan decision. Trump wins, we get out. Now, I think, you know, I did that, and we could have our, you know, we could have it inspired by Brexit. We could call it Axit or something like that, you know, which would play on this kind of peculiar way that Australians say their A's, which the Americans like to pick it up, which I learned to my embarrassment when I lived over there. But yeah, I do think, though, that as much as I was sort of trying to make tongue-in-cheek comments last year, there has been instances of overreaction to Trump's victory in the last week. There's been the sort of Chicken Little, the sky is falling kind of response. And it made me remember something that during my stint when I was based in Canberra reporting politics, that a senior Liberal strategist told me in the aftermath of the 2012 US election, when I was asking whether or not there were any lessons that could be learned in Australia from the US experience. And he said to me at the time that one of the biggest mistakes that that people make after an election is to assume that the winner has done everything right and that the loser has done everything wrong. And it is easy to miss, and I'm not disagreeing with Aaron's point that there has been a demonstrable double standard in this election. But Clinton was very close to winning. And if not for the peculiarities of the electoral college system, which are not that dissimilar to our own parliament in that sense, then it could have been a very different outcome by only a few hundred thousand votes, really. So there's a lot to learn from the election, and I think that it would be a mistake for the Democrats to just chuck out the entire bathwater, baby included, in the aftermath of this, as much as a shock as it really is. All that said, I do find it perplexing that there are efforts to discover a virtue now in Donald Trump, because he's got this patina of legitimacy that he's won by winning an election. A lot of the things that he spoke about, evident by his character, you talked about the video, things like that are, I think, you know, a lot of Australians will find an anathema. Now, we can't be too holier than thou in all of this, because we've had our own, well, we haven't produced a Donald Trump quite figure, we've had our own pretty interesting political experience over the last 5 years. And arguably, you know, we could be a little bit conceited about this and say, well, our system is at least better able to cope with pent-up anger in the community, because we can change leaders midstream in the way in which it's much more difficult to do in the United States. That said, there was a 2012 election in the US and they didn't kick out Obama then. So we've had a lot of changes of leadership, and maybe those changes of leadership that we've had here in Australia has meant that we're less susceptible to the kind of pent-up anger which has now manifested itself in this extraordinary that is going to be the next US president.
And I would just add on to Dan's point, it was so much closer than it even has been reported in the press. So it appears that Hillary Clinton will finish with just over 2 million more votes than Donald Trump in the popular vote. That's pretty extraordinary. Al Gore won more votes in the popular vote in 2000 than George W. Bush, but it wasn't by nearly that margin.
In a context where 60 million people voted for Trump.
Yeah, but close president to 100. Right. So I think about 40 million for each. I have to go back and look at the exact numbers. They're still counting votes.
But just,
votes.
Just to your point, and sorry, I'm not playing with my phone here and being rude, but this was a thing that was passed around in our newsroom earlier today. If you Google, so not Facebook, as much as we can blame Facebook for fake news, but if you Google final election results, the first report that you find is a Washington first result that you get is a Washington Post report about the second result that you get, which is actually one of these fake news websites, which has in the aftermath of the election. So you're searching for final election results. The headline you get is video of election left-wing violence from unhinged Democrat wackos. Hey, Democrats, you seem to breed thugs the way you abort babies with pride.
Nice.
That's the sort of media environment that... Mm. that you know, we find ourselves operating in.
Yep.
Just zooming out again, Aaron, on the policy implications for this, how will a President Trump, or President-elect, sorry, it's a bit of a mouthful, approach American foreign policy in Asia? Is he likely to pull back as he said he would? What is going to happen with those alliances and that alliance system? What impact is this going to have on the security dynamic in the region?
Well, again, there's a lot of uncertainty because we just don't know who he will appoint as his advisors. And there is a bit of a transition team. We know who some of those early advisors are. They probably won't be what we call the principals, the top level leaders in foreign policy. And some of them are actually quite reasonable. And there's talk about bringing people in, like, for example, a guy named Randy Shriver, who's run his own think tank for the last 10 years. Probably expected he would not have a chance to serve in government again for a long time, but he was one of the few Republicans in national security who did not sign one of the Never Trump letters, even though Randy's views are pretty clearly Never Trump. And so if Randy were to go into a Trump administration, that could actually be a pretty reasonable Asia policy. And so there's a possibility that this will be a very conventional Republican policy when it comes to East Asia, that you'll see, for instance, with the situation with North Korea's nuclear program, a real facsimile of the policy that Hillary Clinton would have enacted anyways, getting tougher on that nuclear program, trying to find a way to apply the lessons learned from the Iran deal to the North Korean program. And so it's possible that in this region, policy won't change that much. And I think, you know, those of us in think tanks and who try to influence policy, although I was never Trump and I certainly won't be going into a Trump administration, it's incumbent upon us to encourage our Republican friends to go in so that Trump gets some good advice from people who know what they're talking about, and you know that that we push the administration toward a responsible position in East Asia, because I think it's very likely, based on the numbers we talked about a moment ago, that Trump will lose in 2020, particularly when his supporters find out that everything he has promised them is impossible, and you know, and they sort of revolt against him. And I don't think we should break everything over the next 4 years. I don't think Canberra should break everything or leave the ANZUS treaty sometime in the next 4 years, because there's a very, very good chance that we'll all wake up on November 2nd, 2020, and this long nightmare will be over.
Predictions have proved very fraught, though, Aaron. This is
particularly ours.
Yeah. This is a dangerous business. I mean, I broadly agree. I think that there's some danger in assuming orthodoxy now when he has demonstrated an inability or an unwillingness or in many ways a determined opposition to the orthodoxy. And I think that he has promised red meat to voters and now he has to feed them. And it's a question about how he's going to do that. And, you know, if we can talk in I said this to Aaron earlier, so he won't be offended, but in kind of tabloid terms, the kind of ambulance-chasing diplomacy, which happens in response to events, so China goes out and decides that it's going to build some artificial islands in the South China Sea, or there's fears about Iran building a nuclear weapon. I don't mean to be flippant. These are really important issues. But a lot of them become very reactive. The kind of prosperity agenda, if I can use that term, which I'm borrowing from others, is things like trade. And there was a big push on for the Trans-Pacific Partnership as a part, sort of a part of the Obama legacy. Now, you've likely heard of this and you've probably got views about it, but chances are with Trump's election now, it's dead. And it seems to me that that Australia is now operating on the assumption that the TPP is dead, whereas last week they were operating on the assumption that even though Hillary Clinton had been opposed to it throughout the campaign, that the TPP would be put forward for potential ratification during the lame duck period between November and January in ahead of a Clinton administration. I don't think that there's any expectation that that's now going to happen. So what does Trump do with regard to the kind of prosperity agenda, if I can call it that? He's talked about renegotiating trade agreements like NAFTA. He's talked about building a big wall with Mexico, but there's all these supply chains that connect for car manufacturers between the two countries. That could have potential real ramifications. for the United States. But he's also talked about calling China a currency manipulator and calling out China as a currency manipulator and putting punitive tariffs on China. That could in turn have big implications for the US, domestic markets and economy. So there's a lot to kind of, what was it Harold Macmillan said, you know, events, dear boy, events. But we get a sense that he is a conviction protectionist, and that will have interesting ramifications for Australia.
I accept that that's the likely case, but I actually think that there is a chance that Donald Trump is not so much a conviction protectionist, although it's clear, as our boss Michael Fullilove has said, he's held these views since the late 80s. He's been a protectionist for a long time. But it also seems like Donald Trump is against any deal that he wasn't personally responsible for concluding. And I wonder if, you know, we're now looking at a situation in which if Donald Trump renegotiates something, which certainly would not be called the Trans-Pacific Partnership, but looks a lot like it, if that's something that he then pushes with Congress. Because the imperative to liberalize and to raise standards in this region is actually something that should speak to it. The politics of this got really mixed up in the last 2 years with labor unions opposing the Trans-Pacific Partnership. But it was intended to raise labor standards, raise environmental standards in countries like Malaysia and Vietnam that are competing with the United States. It was actually intended to give developed countries like the U.S. and Australia a competitive edge.
Here's a fascinating prospect, and I'm just doing it to stir, but you know, say the United States backs away from the TPP. What happens if China says, well, actually, we wouldn't mind being a part of this, and we've always felt that it was opposed to us, but if the United States is not going to be continuing with it, but you've done all this negotiation, how about we pick it up and we can carry on with it as well? So, yeah, I mean, who knows?
I think, you know, ultimately, though, when it comes to East Asia policy, as one commentator put it last week, it looks like the pivot to Asia, Obama's pivot to Asia, or the rebalance, if you prefer the latter term, it was dead. But his argument was, you know, the rebalance is dead. Long live the rebalance. Because the imperatives to focus on this region, because of the size of the economies in this region, and because of the strategic math, are not going away. And once Trump gets into the White House, and it'll probably take him 4 to 5 months to actually staff the administration. It's about 3,000 jobs that turn over in the U.S. between administrations, political appointees that go in. Once he actually gets a grasp on what's going on, and if he has some good advisors in there, he may actually realize that the Obama administration's agenda was sort of the obvious one, and that whatever partisan fulmination he made against it, he may end up having to enact that very same agenda and calling it something different.
What about the region's response to a President Trump foreign policy? Is this going to create some sort of pivot away from the US and towards China? We've already seen an indication of that in the Philippines. Is that likely to happen?
Just on China, the point I was making with Chinese that I was speaking to in the week before the election is if Duterte is your friend, then you've got a real problem. And you could make the same argument about Donald Trump, but the Chinese have alarmed the region, and the region isn't all that terribly happy with the US response either. In that, you know, there's been mixed messages that have come through. The pivot is I think the language is a big part of the problem, because the pivot was this early term that Hillary Clinton was using when she was Secretary of State, and it was appropriated by the White House and became Obama's term. But it implied turning the back on somewhere else. And all this stuff becomes interconnected, and there's only so much attention that your top policymakers can ever give to one particular issue. And one of the complaints that's been regular in Australia over the last term of the Obama administration is that John Kerry has been so focused on the Middle East that he hasn't been paying enough attention to Asia, particularly with all this stuff happening in the South China Sea. And so Kerry's been off negotiating and tried to negotiate a peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians, didn't have any joy there, so went to Iran, managed to get a new deal. I credit him in the sense that all of these things are interrelated. If you want to truly pivot towards Asia or rebalance towards Asia, then you have to be able to take some attention away from from the other hotspots in the world. And part of that was to try and resolve some of these tensions in the Middle East, where the United States had for a long time been so dependent on the oil resources and the like from that region. A lot of that has changed with technology in recent years. So to unpack it all and simplify it as simply, well, how is the region going to respond to China really depends on how the United States responds to the region and how it responds in other parts of the world too. We haven't even mentioned Europe and what happens in Europe. And I think this is a really fascinating prospect in the coming year. We've already seen Brexit. Now we've got Trump. And if we're honest, the economy's probably not going to fall over tomorrow, although allowing the predictions are really problematic. Even after January when he gets re-elected. So does Marie Le Pen win in France now? And what happens in the German elections? And even if it's not far-right candidates, is there a lot of support for a more protectionist mood? And does this sort of become a contagion that starts spreading around the world? And what does this mean for the West? And there's Vladimir Putin. And what is he going to do? And these sort of things. So complicated. Cop-out answer.
That's a good time to then take it to the audience. It's complicated. So there are a couple of microphones on either side and we'll take questions from anybody who puts their hand up and a microphone can find them, and a lady in the middle there. Thank you. Now, again, just a bit more housekeeping. If you could just identify yourself and keep yourself to a question and not a comment, we'll be very grateful. Thank you.
Hi, my name's Elizabeth. I was just wondering how we might consider the role of voter turnout in the result of the election.
Oh, thank you. That's a Dorothy Dixer for me. I think there are three reasons why polling has now got a very bad name, thanks to the US election and then before that the Brexit and then before that the UK election. There have been a series of polling catastrophes which have really brought polling into disrepute. Firstly, given that I'm a pollster, I'd like to say that I think most of this is applicable to election polling. And secondly, I think the big difference is the non-compulsory nature of American polling, which is what you've put your finger on there, and also obviously applied in the UK with the Brexit vote. Now, there are two other issues which I think are factors, and then I'll go on to the voter turnout issue because there are some initial data now coming in on that. Firstly, there's this shy Trump phenomenon, and we saw something similar in the UK with the shy Tory voter in 2015, where people with conservative views who are seeking to have some sort of a surprising result or outcome are a bit shy about admitting that, particularly in a telephone interview when it's a sort of a person-to-person interaction. Now, that's been discounted a little bit in the United States because a lot of the polling that was done that was proven to be slightly inaccurate was actually done online, and the idea of a shy or conservative voter unwilling to admit that they hold a certain set of views tends to dissipate with online polling, where it's a lot less personal interaction. The other factor is this idea of polling on election eve. The polls leading up to an election, they were in the case of Brexit, they were in the case of the UK elections in 2015 and then again in this most recent US election, is that polls which seem to be decisive and which seem to point to a clear result in the election, and the margins were up to about 9 and sometimes greater than that, 9% in favour of Hillary Clinton. As I mentioned, 9 out of 10 polls predicted that win, and sometimes by quite large margins. In fact, tends to lull the people who are in favour of the status quo, in this case a Democrat government, and lull them in a false sense of security, and so they don't bother to go out and vote. So that's the second factor. But the third factor is this voter turnout, which is obviously related to the second one. But it looks like the turnout of this election was one of the lowest in two decades. 55.6 at latest estimate turned out to vote here, compared with 62% in 2008 and slightly fewer in 2012. A lot of attention has been paid to older white males. There's been less attention paid to older white females. They turned out in force. traditionally, when you talk about demographics as with respect to age, the biggest turnout is in the 60 plus, and then the 45s, and then the 30 to 45s, and then the under 30s. And in the Brexit vote, only around 35% of the under 30s turned out to vote, but they were more than 70% in favour of the Remain. In US elections, around the same proportion, between 30 and 40% of that age group turn out to vote. In this case, in the US election case, 55% of them were in favour of Hillary Clinton, while only around 35% of them were in favour of Donald Trump. So that sort of margin and that sort of swing can decide a vote. And I think there's been too little attention actually paid to that demographic and the influence of that demographic and the turnout of young voters who were so clearly in favour of Hillary Clinton. And a lot of attention has been paid to the angry white male, the lower Hispanic turnout than for the Obama election, and the African-American turnout, and not enough has been paid to the youth turnout. And that's a big issue for us here. We have had a long line of polling results which have suggested that that age group is really disillusioned with politics in Australia. That reflects results from similar questions around the world, where there's sort of a general disenchantment with the democratic process and the way our political system is working. And I think that had a big impact on this election. Next question. Sorry to go on for so long.
If I could just add to that, Alex. The New York Times did an analysis of the election, and it turns out that if only 53,000 people, and again, an election in which nearly 100 million people cast ballots, 53,000 people in three states changed their votes, then Hillary Clinton would have had more than 300 electoral college votes, would have won in an electoral college landslide. And so this was an extremely close election. And in each of those three states, there were massive voter suppression efforts by Republicans in the state legislature in the last 3 years. So to go into a little bit of background, the Voting Rights Act of 1965 was challenged in the Supreme Court a few years ago, and the Supreme Court ruled that it was unconstitutional in some areas. And the Republican state legislatures in those areas immediately went about going and looking at the data, one area in which they look at data, looking at the data to determine where and when African Americans vote, where and when young people vote. So to just take one example, in North Carolina, in 2012, if you were a student at Duke University, you could vote on campus. This year, if you wanted to vote as a North Carolinian, you had to take a bus 20 minutes away to go vote. That was intentional.
And then stand in a long line.
Exactly. And they realized that African Americans tended to vote during early voting. We have weeks-long early voting in the U.S. Following the 2000 election. This was expanded dramatically. African-Americans tended to vote on Sunday afternoons after church. North Carolina got rid of Sunday early voting. So in some of these areas, there was enough voter suppression to make the difference in this election. And you're going to see a massive effort by Democrats to challenge those laws and to go to court and say, you know, look, this was intentional. It was directed at specific privileged groups under the Constitution, and try and get those laws overturned. And you could see a very different electorate in 2020 as a result of that. The last thing I just mentioned is, in terms of young voters, one of the reasons that it's thought that young voters didn't turn out in the numbers that we had expected, or they turned out for Obama, was just because this campaign was so negative. We've never seen two candidates in an election have such high negatives. And so many young voters who supported Bernie Sanders in the primary had sort of believed the rhetoric that Bernie's people had put out about Hillary Clinton and decided that it was really just a case of the lesser of two evils. There was no inspiring candidate in this case. I couldn't agree less. But that's what they believed, and that's one of the reasons that many of them didn't show up at the polls.
Donald Trump has spoken about America's relationship with Japan and South Korea. However, there's been very little talk about his Taiwan policy. Do any of you have any idea what his Taiwan policy might be? Because I think that's one of the most important in East Asia right now.
Okay.
No.
Dan.
It's the honest truth? No, I don't. I mean, this goes to Aaron's point about the people that are around him. You might have seen it, but I didn't see those sorts of specifics put to him during the campaign, and I'm not aware of him having, you know, he talks about himself as a deal maker, as a businessman, as somebody who approaches the world with a kind of a ruthlessness in that sense. But I don't get any sense of where he's going to stand on that issue, but you might know more.
So one of the really bizarre things about Donald Trump's foreign policy team, there's going to be one of many, but one of the bizarre things is that for a guy who apparently is deeply skeptical of American alliances and thinks that we need to be tougher on our allies and basically turn our alliance, our hub-and-spoke alliance network in the Asia-Pacific into effectively a protection racket, his advisors on Asia are incredibly pro-Taiwan. And so you look at the foreign policy op-ed that was written on Monday last week, which was the first indication of an Asia policy that we'd seen out of the Trump campaign a day before the election. But the two advisors who wrote that, Peter Navarro and Alex Gray, are both big boosters of the U.S. relationship with Taiwan. They think that the Obama administration slighted Taiwan by not selling them top-shelf weapons, when in fact, actually, that has long been U.S. policy. We always sell them sort of the middle option. We don't sell them the least amount of weapons. We don't sell them the most. And then China complains, and then they get over it. So it's sort of a pattern that we've developed over time in order to ensure stability so that Taiwan gets some weapons so it can defend itself, but Beijing doesn't go nuts. You might expect these Republicans, if they do indeed go in with Donald Trump and they have a lot of influence on his thinking, to be really hardcore on Taiwan and to give them all the weapons that they want, particularly with Tsai Ing-wen as the new Taiwanese president, much more so than her predecessor, Ma Ying-jeou, is going to ask for the top-shelf stuff.
Michael McGrath, I'm interested in the extrapolation, if there is one, to be made from the US to the Australian community, and that is, does Donald Trump's methodology represent a role model for the next Prime Minister of Australia at the next election? Is there something that he's done that our leaders should learn from in order to get elected?
Yeah, well, Malcolm Turnbull went on the 7:30 report last night instead of bashing elites. Maybe. But it's kind of weird, isn't it, when it's a white male complaining about elites. And that's if they're the ones that turned out to vote. And
especially a billionaire white male.
Look, I've actually been thinking about exactly this and wondering on this very point. I think that early thinking that Trump is quite unique in that his profile, his celebrity, his kind of character in that, and his bombast and his ability to just keep talking and to segue. And did you notice that he was talking about that video and when he said terrible things about women? But I'm going to smash ISIS. And all of this happens within a sentence. Yeah, sure, you could have someone that'll try and ape it, and maybe someone will do it better one day. But I think Trump's built up this character over such a long period, and he has this ability to change the subject, in a sense, with some new outrage. That, sure, you could see someone doing it, and I don't mean to in any way compare him, but here in Melbourne, there was some talk about Sam Newman running for Melbourne Mayor. Maybe he could do the same thing. This is being recorded and broadcast, apparently. But nonetheless, maybe there is a model in all of that, but I think there's a limit. And I also think, and this was the point I was trying to get to earlier, I don't know that you can do it in Australia, because I think it requires a great pent-up of anger, which is something that is not unique, but is more particular to the United States because of the four-year term system that they have, whereas we can see things change in our system, as we've discovered in the last few years, fairly regularly. So I think there's some more flexibility here, which means that a Trump-like demagogue is less likely in our type of politics, but then never say never.
And if it's instructive, there were a number of candidates who ran in Republican primaries earlier this year who tried to ape Trump, and almost all of them lost. And the conclusion of the New York Times columnist Frank Bruni was, Trumpism is a virus, but Trump is the host, and it finds it very difficult to live outside the host.
Yeah.
And so, he's a particular individual in that he was this reality TV star. And, I actually had never, this is, maybe one of those divisions between elites and non-elites. I had never seen The Apprentice in America.
Neither.
But a lot of people did. And they liked Donald Trump. He is a charismatic individual in a particular way. And so I think maybe we don't have to worry so much about Trumpism living outside the host, and particularly in Australia, because you all are all so much better folks and better looking than Americans.
Well, as Paul Keating put it the other night on 7:30 Report, we're a much better society than America. Famous last words.
Hi. You mentioned before that Trump might lose a lot of political capital when he can't deliver on a lot of his promises. I'm just curious to what extent you think that might be offset by him doing what he, the other thing he promised, which was eliminate the gridlock in Washington, and given he has a sort of balance of power, he might be able to get things done, and that combined with his spin, you know, to what extent do you think that might, pardon the pun, trump the lack of promise delivery?
That's a great question. I think, you know, John Edwards, who's a non-resident fellow at the Lowy Institute, we had a conversation with him on Friday in which he said the U.S. economy is doing spectacularly well. You know, we're at under 5% unemployment, which is pretty good in the U.S. We're at 2.5% growth, which is pretty good for a developed economy. And Obama's gotten none of the credit for that, but I'm sure that Donald Trump will try to take credit for it. And so I wonder if, you know, in 2020, the economy is humming along, doing pretty well, based on the policies that have been enacted over the last 8 years, if you know, Trump will take credit for that and benefit from that. A lot of political scientists' models, although many of their models were really upset by this election, it suggests that if the economy is doing really well, the incumbent party stays in power. And so if there's not another recession before then certainly he could try. In terms of the gridlock in Washington, you know, it's interesting. The same people who voted for Trump were the people who are voting for the people who made that gridlock possible, right? And so a lot of the policies that Donald Trump wants to enact now, like a big infrastructure push, a lot of fiscal spending on infrastructure. President Obama in 2009 proposed an infrastructure bank that would do exactly that, and Republicans in Congress opposed it. So one key question is, how does Donald Trump relate to those Republicans in Congress? Are Paul Ryan and the Republican caucus in the House going to roll over and say, we opposed reckless fiscal spending as part of Obama's infrastructure bank, but now that Donald Trump's supporting it, we'll support it? Or do they sort of stand up on principle, because a lot of them are actually quite ideological, close to libertarians, and say, no, this is outrageous. It was outrageous when Obama proposed it. It was outrageous when Bush overspent, and we're going to oppose this as well. So I would look very carefully at how the relationship between the White House and the Republicans in Congress evolve, because it may not be that sunny, and we may actually see quite a bit of gridlock in the end regardless.
And you could take that further too, and you could look at the relationship that officials have and the sort of the easy crossover there is between being out of government and coming back in and being ideological, and whether or not Trump, I think Obama said today in his assessment that he didn't think that Trump was that ideologically wedded, that he has a, you know, he obviously has a few issues that he's keen on, but that a lot of it's about his sort of style and bombast, and that was always a doubt for the conservatives is how conservative Trump actually was. So if you look at that kind of a easy relationship there is with officialdom and this notion of elites and the idea of cleaning some of that out, there's going to be a lot of support for that, I think, but it's how do you demonstrate it? How do you demonstrate progress on this? Because, again, difficult to quote Obama when you're talking about Trump, but Obama realised, I think he said today, you know, it's not a yacht, it's not a speedboat, the ship of state. It's the Dreamliner. It's massive. It takes a long time to turn around. So, how is Trump going to bring back jobs to Michigan, which is one of his key promises? How is he going to make Mexico pay for that wall? And is he going to be held though to account on the kind of promises that he's been making? And this is where I think the media interplay is really kind of interesting and fascinating. The media that has been barracking for Trump is a kind of media that defines itself by opposition. It's opposed to something. Now, what's it going to be opposed to when it has its present champion in power? And Trump may find that the same media that has been boosting him turns against him pretty quickly. Or it could be that Trump continues to bond by exclusion by demonising the other, and that's where attitudes towards Muslims, attitudes towards minorities, attitudes towards women, attitudes towards other countries. That all becomes fascinating questions, but I don't think we have any answers on those points yet.
Yeah, and on that latter point, Steve Bannon's appointment to, you know, the second most senior post in the White House is really dispiriting, because it suggests that that's exactly what Trump will try to do. When things go bad, he'll blame it on immigrants, he'll blame it on African Americans, he'll blame it on whoever.
Okay, I might take, since there's competition for questions, the gentleman up there with his hand up, I think, was earlier as well. I'll take three questions straight after each other and then you two ladies here, and I'll take three questions and perhaps we can answer all three together.
This question is entirely speculative and you may not want to answer, but I remember reading an article, like, this is a while ago, maybe 12 months ago, suggesting that Trump would not only blow himself up but blow up the GOP. I think the way that was interpreted at the time is that he wouldn't become elected and the election result would be so disastrous that would achieve that outcome. Given that he's now been elected, given that a lot of the GOP establishment seem to be climbing aboard the Trump Express, I suppose I've started to wonder whether that outcome will be achieved, but it just might be 4 years later, that the GOP establishment, if the Trump presidency does blow up, they're not going to have anywhere to hide, and they can't blame a Congress that's uncooperative. So I don't know. I just kind of wondered if what your thoughts are about that. Maybe you prefer not to give your thoughts. That's fine.
Okay, thank you very much. And I'll go to the next question down here. Who's got the microphone there? Sorry. Yes. I'm taking three questions in a row and then we'll answer them all together. Thank you.
Hi, I was just wondering if you could make some statements about the trajectory of the Supreme Court in the next few years. Obviously, Merrick Garland is not going to be nominated. Is there any kind of legal safeguard or etiquette even that could prevent Trump from stacking the bench with conservative views, particularly if he's going to be appointing potentially three judges?
Yep, thank you. And then there was one last question, this lady. If you could just pass it down again. Sorry. Thanks.
Thank you. So my question goes back to the media again, particularly Donald Trump and the New York Times, with his tweets threatening to sue them, which were somewhat funny and a little bit eye-rolling when he was a candidate. Now he's fired another one off again this morning and he's president-elect. I'd be interested in your thoughts as to how you think New York Times' relationship with Donald Trump, as well as other media outlets, might function while he's actually president.
Okay, thank you. Aaron, the GOP, the future of the GOP.
Well, nothing brings people together like victory and patronage, right? So I think that you're going to see Republicans try to make this work. There's some discussion about, does the House caucus not reelect Paul Ryan as Speaker? And you only need a few Republican defections to make that happen. So I think that's possible. And that would actually make a much more cohesive Republican Party if you had a Republican further to the right or an anti-trade Republican as Speaker of the House. But I think you're probably right. You are just sort of delaying the inevitable for 4 years. And the other important thing to note here is there is part of the Republican establishment that never signed up to Trump and never will. And, you know, that's, for instance, the Conservative National Review, which is William F. Buckley's magazine, Bill Kristol and the Weekly Standard. And they're probably going to, they're going to criticize Trump when they feel it's warranted on ideological grounds. And then you also have groups like the Chamber of Commerce, the largest lobby group in the United States. Chamber of Commerce is going to fight tooth and nail against protectionism. And they'll fight against Republican candidates in primaries that propose protectionism and things like that. So you'll actually see fights between a Republican White House and the Chamber of Commerce, which is right across the street in an extraordinarily powerful lobby, sort of the business association. And so I think that'll be interesting to watch. But I think you're probably right. It doesn't look good in 4 years for the GOP. In terms of the Supreme Court, if I can just go to that real quick before Dan talks about media. I think Ruth Bader Ginsburg is going to literally hang on for dear life. She didn't want to resign under Obama because she thought that he wouldn't appoint someone liberal enough for her. So she's certainly going to try and hang on as long as possible. And I have some confidence Anthony Kennedy and others probably will as well, who might not have done that for just any old Republican, but will under Trump. The other sort of hopeful note is, you have six Republicans in the Senate out of 51 who came out and said they would never vote for Donald Trump, even indicated they didn't vote for him, or would never support him, and indicated they wouldn't vote for him, who are pretty strongly opposed to some of the far-right things that Donald Trump wants to do. And so you only need a few of those to block Supreme Court nominations. So if he does try to stack the court with really outrageous figures, then I think they'll be voted down. He will have to find a sort of middle ground. And he actually seems relatively moderate on issues. He used to be moderate on abortion, although now apparently he's become very conservative. But he's, for instance, moderate on gay rights and suggested he wouldn't try to overturn the decision 2 years ago that made gay marriage legal. So I think there are some signs of hope. He's actually going to have to work within the system on that one. And when FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, tried to stack the court in the 1930s by just adding more judges, that was considered so far beyond the pale that even his own party opposed it. And while I'm loath to predict the survival of certain norms these days based on what's happened this year, I think that's one where those six Republicans would stand up and say, no, that's outside the bounds of what we do.
Just before I get to media, just on this, remember Obama promised to close Guantanamo, and it's still open. It can be very hard to make these things come true. The media, media people, we don't love to talk about ourselves. The difficulty is we talk about media, and New York Times is a good example. I'll focus on the New York Times in a minute, but we talk about the media in this sort of broad sense, category media, as if we've all got this, we get our writing instructions every morning. And, to some extent there is a pack mentality, and press gaggles tend to run in packs, and there is a sort of, there's echo chambers, and we've seen a huge example of that perhaps in this election. I think we have. But what we as an industry have been grappling with and not all that good at talking about with the rest of the community, although the rest of the community is a big part of it, is we're dying as a journalistic industry. I say dying, it's dying hopefully like the phoenix, that we're burning but we'll rise again and it'll be stronger, but it's this process of trying to figure out how it's going to all happen. I'm excited about a lot of the digital stuff. A lot of the digital stuff's really fun. I went down to Sea Shepherd today, boring Aaron about this earlier. We took a video team down there. I work for a newspaper, but we took a video team down there. All of these sorts of things are happening, and that's what we think, you, the public, expect. But what is also happening is that our role as traditional gatekeepers of news and information, that's been shattered. And it means that you've got a Donald Trump who's got, 15 million Twitter followers or something like that. He's got an enormous broadcast platform which he can have a go at the New York Times, but it's amplified because we all report what he's saying on Twitter. So he's sort of, in a sense, kind of cutting out the need to have an interview. Now, this is not unique to Donald Trump. This is happening all the way around. And social media is very confronting for a lot of journalists because it gives them direct insight into a lot of hateful responses, and people get that in their own social media networks. But long way of answering your question, sorry. But what I think this election could well focus public attention on is what we as an industry have been really struggling with digital disruption, and that, borrow the boring old cliche of my grandmother, in life you get what you pay for. And if people are not willing to pay for news, they're going to get a lot of the free made-up crap. And news, getting real news, and we don't do it perfectly, but getting real news is expensive. It is a business, and we don't do it through the old models of advertising and subscription anymore. We just can't, and we're not going to get those days back, and not going to be healthy-minded about it, that sort of thing. But I've got a mortgage, I've got kids to feed, I want to get paid. If I'm not going to make money as a journalist, then I'll go back to washing dishes in Mexican restaurants, which is what, and hopefully I can climb the wall when I get there. But I think what we've seen, try and be a little bit more predictive. What's going to happen under Trump I think what we've seen happen is the opportunity, whether or not it happens, I don't know, but there's an opportunity now that the public will actually focus on the relationship between the media and its understanding of the world, understanding of politics, and realising that the power, which has always been greatly skewed in favour of governments, because as much as they blame the media for casting direction and changing narratives, that sort of thing, governments have extraordinary power on this. It's actually even more concentrated in the hands of government and what social media and the like can do. And that stratification of the media has weakened what were strong, strong voices in oppositional sense. I don't know that, you know, in the United States that you will see them trying to clamp down on it legally, that sort of thing. I think freedom of speech protections are very strong in the US, and I think that's quite well embedded. But you'll see this sort of angry oppositionism and the ability for he's going to have a great bullet at the White House, which is going to be even stronger than his Twitter feed. But I bet he doesn't give up Twitter.
I don't want to end on that depressing note, no. So I'm going to ask you both for one very brief comment about some advice for the Australian government, just one comment from each of you, how to deal with the President Trump.
I guess I would say this. There's been a lot of my colleagues and my friends back home have really been questioning who we are as a people over the last week, and because we did not think this was possible. And what I would tell you is, based on all the things that I said about how close an election this was, the fact that Hillary Clinton won the popular vote, is that we are still the same people that we were a week ago. And there is then a tremendous energy among liberals in Washington and on the coasts, and hopefully this will spread to the interior states as well, to fight back and to prevent any of the really nasty stuff that Donald Trump wants to do from happening. And so my hope is that in 4 years I can come back to Melbourne, and we'll be talking about, you know, sort of a new era of liberalism and progressivism in the U.S. And so my advice to the government in Canberra at this point is, you know, don't junk the alliance. There are ways to express displeasure with some of the things that Donald Trump wants to do. For instance, if the United States begins to adopt enhanced interrogation methods again, I think that's something that Australia should very clearly indicate that it will have no part in. But don't junk the alliance, because we may be back in 4 years, and you know, we'll want that relationship in good tact.
It's going to be bad, and it's a question of how bad.
We're supposed to be ending on.
I know. I'm going to come to that. Look,
don't leave it up to me.
I've seen a lot in the last week about how Australia should react and respond, and I think there is the main thing for Australia is to hold true to what we think as Australians, what we think are our values and our interests. And we should be judging every relationship and every issue in the world on the basis of those issues. And that doesn't change with Donald Trump or when you're dealing with China or when you're dealing with any other international partner. I mean, I think that we have... There's been some talk about, oh, there's time to put some distance between Australia and the United States. It really depends what Trump does. It really depends what he does. Exactly. And if I heard you right, there's no point in being preemptive on this, because we've just shown ourselves at being really bad at predictions. So I think we have to, I know it's a cop-out, but I do think we have to wait and see. Mm. I don't think that the sky is going to fall in immediately. I don't entirely disagree. There wasn't immediately there, was there? I don't entirely agree that we might see a sort of liberal utopia, I'm teasing Aaron, but we might see a liberal utopia sort of grow out of Donald Trump. But that said, you know, the opportunity that there is for the United States and its soft power kind of appeal, that hasn't disappeared, and that's not going to be replaced when China comes with a bag full of money for Sam Dastyari. So I'm sorry, I'm doing it again. So I think we have to wait and we have to respond to to what he actually does.
Keep calm, carry on.
Keep calm.
Ladies and gentlemen, keep calm and carry on. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. It's been a fascinating discussion. I hope you agree. Obviously, many questions remain unanswered. For those of you who are curious after tonight as to how this is all going to affect Australia, we actually are releasing next month a new Lowy Institute paper by James Curran, professor in history from the University of Sydney, who's the author of the next Lowy Institute paper, Fighting with America, aptly titled, on the contemporary Australia-US alliance. It's released on the 8th of December. James has been busy rewriting the preface to his paper and making a few key edits before it's published, but that'll be out very shortly. And thank you very much to you for your very good questions, for your patience where I couldn't see you, and thank you for coming. And thank you to our panellists. So.